This is Fresh Air. My guest is the voice of Homer Simpson's boss and lots of other characters on The Simpsons, but you'll also recognize his voice from his political satire on All Things Considered. You probably also know Harry Shearer as a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. But what elevated him to cult status was his role in the rock documentary spoof This Is Spinal Tap. Shearer played the part of the band's bass player, Derek Smalls. The band Spinal Tap parodies heavy metal music, the self-indulgent musicians who play it, and the excesses of their stage shows. Real heavy metal music has been topping the record charts, and Spinal Tap is gearing up for a reunion tour. They have a new record coming out next month. I asked Harry Shearer how the members of Spinal Tap decided to reunite.
Really, what happened was that Christopher Guest and Michael McKean and I independently found ourselves at a Squeeze concert at the Universal Amphitheater. And I was walking around the periphery of the interior of the building waiting for the opening act to conclude and ran into him in the lobby. And we just started exchanging anecdotes about how, in the absence of any entrepreneurial or marketing push, this thing had just sort of grown as a phenomenon, as a cult phenomenon, as it's called, over the years. And we're just sort of musing, gee, you know, this thing is probably bigger than ever. We started asking people, who are paid to know these things, and they said, yeah, there's probably something here. So we thought, well, let's see. It'd be fun to do it again.
Now, you've been on tour before with Spinal Tap, right?
Well, the only tour that Spinal Tap really did was a very short kind of mini tour, and we only played clubs. We played like 500-seat clubs because we really didn't have a big stage show, and we didn't want to look really stupid standing on a big stage with nothing except ourselves and our instruments. So this will be the first time we'll go into really big venues.
Like stadiums? You're going to do stadiums?
No. Terry, get hold of yourself.
I thought maybe you'd be opening for Aerosmith.
Calm down, girl. Well, there'll be a few big festivals that the Spinal Tap may play in England that'll be frighteningly large, but basically we're talking about like 5,000-seat kind of facilities.
So what kind of sets do you have now?
Sets. Well, they're being designed as we speak. And since the budgetary process is a very live component of that, I can't really tell you yet. It'll be grand. Grand and stupid.
What kind of sex have you been having?
Grand and stupid.
When you're a parody heavy metal band, do you have parodies of groupies hanging out backstage waiting for you?
Well, again, since we haven't done the real tour, we had what seemed like very real groupies the last time. I mean, the interesting thing about the whole project is that some of the people who are attracted to it get every nuance and know every wrinkle of what's supposed to be funny about it, and some people are there because they think it's at least borderline legitimate. And I think the same was true of the people that gathered backstage. The other thing that's interesting about groupiedom these days is apparently you really get what you ask for, because we have Spinal Tap has a song called Big Bottom. It's one of their more well-known songs. It's everybody plays basses, and it celebrates that particular piece of the anatomy. And that's the description of the women that showed up. So apparently in rock and roll these days, you know, you just put out the specs and they go, oh, that's what they want.
That's pretty strange, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, how did
it's
you...
It's all too linear for me, Terry.
Well, seriously, though, how do you react to all of this? Because after all, you're a parody of the real thing, but real people are coming up taking you seriously as groupies. So what do you... I mean...
Well, you know, it's a very interesting experience, because what it ends up being is we stay in character and deal with everything as these people. So it's really the most bizarre kind of acting experience, because you're acting, you're totally into this other character, and you're interacting with other people who may or may not know what it is you're doing.
So how do you think the heavy metal scene has changed since you did the film? Things you're going to have to really catch up on before you're back on the road in this tour.
Wonderfully enough, this thing became ossified so early, this form. that you can come back after a deep sleep and not really find that you've missed all that much. You know, the stagecraft has advanced, obviously. The technology of putting a show on stage has improved, and the sound has gotten, you'll be glad to know, louder.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. So we recommend the double earplugs.
Right, right. So on to The Simpsons. I have to ask you about The Simpsons.
Yeah.
You're the voice of the assistant to Homer's boss.
I'm also the voice of his boss.
And also, whenever there's somebody really smarmy, you're them too.
Yeah, it's kind of typecasting. I'm the school principal and the school bus driver and the local newscaster and the local preacher and virtually all the doctors they ever run into. I'm the black doctor and the white doctor.
Oh, whenever there's a radio show or a TV show.
Most of the time, yeah, that's me too.
What's the process like? Are you in the studio with a lot of the other people doing voices, or do you all record your parts separately?
No, it's basically like an old radio show. We're all in a large room or in a semicircle with microphones in front of each of us, going scene by scene through the show. We do each scene several times, but that's the only way you get the kind of interplay among actors that I think sets it slightly apart from a lot of shows that are just people doing funny voices.
Now, the characters sync to your voices, or do you do it watching the characters?
No, the artists sync to our voices.
So you haven't seen the drawings when you're recording?
No. With a new character, we very often don't even know how he looks.
You've played a lot of smarmy people in the past few years, both in some of the parts you do in The Simpsons and in movies.
Well, thank you very much.
What is it about you that you're getting those parts?
I think they see the essential smarminess within, Terry.
Yeah, I was setting you up for that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I like to play, if you like to do comedy, and especially sort of slightly edgy comedy, then the people that you think are funny are people who have something severely wrong with them in one way or another, and I guess that's who I get to play.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harry Shearer, one of the voices on The Simpsons. He's about to tour with Spinal Tap, and you, of course, also know him from his political commentaries, his political humor on National Public Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Harry Shearer is my guest. Who were some of the people on TV who made the biggest impression on you when you were growing up? The kinds of announcers or TV commercials or...
you mean not the comedy people?
No, I mean the kind of people who you're kind of parodying in a way.
Oh, well, the voices that I had in my head when I was growing up, these will be fairly obscure people, but bear with me. There was an announcer on the Jack Benny show, not Don Wilson, but there was a guy who did the Lucky Strike commercials from time to time and other commercials too, named Del Sharbat. I've actually run into his kid recently, and I'm probably the only one who said, "Hey, you're Del Sharbat's son." But he had one of these deep, deep voices like that, and that was the first time I heard a guy really pumping the cojones, as you might say. And a lot of the important sounding voices, you know, I was a little young for H.V. Kaltenborn, but I heard him sort of on nostalgia shows and all those documentary voices and Ed Murrow, of course. And those were the voices that first really spoke to me was all the voices of portent and importance on radio and television, Huntley and Brinkley, Cronkite, those guys.
Did you know that you were capable of doing the voice? Because you certainly are. I mean, you do it with irony, but you really know how to get the voice.
Yeah. Well, I know how to be authoritative in totally non-authoritative purposes. When I was a kid, I would just do all those voices, and in my head, it sounded like I was hitting them right on the money. Although I'm sure to my parents, it all sounded like, you know, very indistinct variants of this basic voice. But the thing was, I was learning to make some sort of changes that satisfied me in my head, and that turned out to be, you know, the only clue you have later on. So I was learning to use the tool somehow.
So what was your first break into show business? You were a journalist first.
No, my first break into show business was when I was a child. I was 7 years old, and I got a job on the Jack Benny radio show. So I started kind of at the top, and I've been steadily working my way down ever since.
So who were you on Jack Benny?
I was I worked with him for 8 years, so from time to time I was either Jack Benny as a child or I was a member of this group of kids that he sort of chaperoned around for various activities called the Beverly Hills Beavers.
Did you have a stage mom?
No, I had a regular mom. I had regular parents, very sane parents, which is the only thing you really need to have a good time as a child actor. And of course, it's almost impossible to have them. But it was a wonderful experience, and it is, you know, it's hard to recommend it because there's so many people who have such horror stories to tell. But with sane parents, I mean, the one thing they said was, you can work all you want, because I was way ahead of myself in school anyway, and I would just have been a troublemaker if I hadn't gotten to go out and work. So it was fine with them, but don't. The only thing they wouldn't let me do is be a regular on a series, which was very insightful of them. Because I worked and I had all the fun, but I was not saddled with the responsibility of carrying a show and having 200 people on the crew going, the kid's killing us.
What did you do with all the money that you made as a kid?
I built a hotel on the outskirts of Houston that is currently 65% vacant. No, it wasn't that much money, believe me. And it all went into a trust fund, and it's sort of what I lived on in my early 20s as I searched for the meaning of life.
Which you're still searching for, no doubt.
Which I'm still searching for, yeah. But no, I mean, it was a little cushion to, like, you know, help me through the early part of my post-college years.
I'm thinking back to your Saturday Night Live days, and it seems to me you're doing more political humor now than you were even then.
Only because the political humor I was doing then wasn't allowed to reach the home screen.
Oh.
My ratio of that has pretty much always been the same. It's just how much gets out. I learned from that experience to sort of try to concentrate my activities in places where there are fewer people who can say no.
Is there a connection between your political humor and the fact that you used to be a journalist and had aspired to be one when you were young?
I don't know. I think it has more to do with just what I find funny, you know. I think everybody sort of in the comedy business gravitates to doing the kind of stuff that that makes them laugh, hopefully. I would hope that that's how the business is run. Gee, maybe I've missed something. But it's the stuff that I find amusing. I like the fact that real life keeps serving up these great scenarios that all I have to do is do a little tweaking of, rather than have to, you know, make up whole imaginary hunks of stuff. So it's probably part laziness, too.
Well, I know that you've been watching the presidential campaign. Have you decided who you're going to vote for?
No, I have no idea. And if I did, I probably wouldn't say it on the radio.
Right, right. Would it be bad for you as a humorist to say that on the radio?
Yeah. I tend to avoid benefits and political, you know, occasions where I'm, you know, a lot of satirists will sort of become appendages to movements of one sort or another, and I don't like to do that. I don't like to be regarded as kept by any part of the spectrum. I reserve the right to make fun of whoever I think is funny.
That worrying about offending them and owing them a favor.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse Jackson is one of the great funny political characters on the scene, you know, whatever else he may be, whatever else you may think of what he does, it's just, you know, a guy who rhymes his way through political life is amusing to me. And very often, especially working in public radio, you find that listeners will respond with some puzzlement when you start making fun of people on the left. And I like doing that as well.
Do people give you a hard time about that?
Not a hard time, but it's you raise more hackles than you'd expect by doing that, you know. And there are certain subjects that, you know, I think these days if you make fun of what I can generally refer to as women's subjects, you'll get into more trouble, or you'll get more reaction than you will if you make fun of George Bush, let's say.
I have to say, you know, since you left Saturday Night Live, I think you've just carved out a really interesting niche and have just kind of like created all these things. You've created this really interesting radio show and commentaries on NPR, Great Voices for The Simpsons, odd roles in lots of movies, mm-hmm. Spinal Tap. It just seems like a very original career that you've created for yourself.
Well, I thanks, I guess. I have sort of... had the thought that I was I wanted to make up my career as I went along rather than get stuck in things. I've been very careful, for example, not to get involved in like a television series where I have to do the same thing every week because I just have a very low tolerance for boredom. If life gets boring, man, I'm out. So I've had to sort of devise a career that could keep at least me interested, if nobody else, you know?
Well, Harry, we're out of time. Good luck on your Spinal Tap tour.
Well, thanks very much. Terry, you got to come see us. I'll give you a backstage pass.
Hey, I can meet all the women with the big bottoms.
That's right. All I can say is wear something black, dear.
Do you have your clothes picked out for the tour?
No. They're all being designed now.
I should have known a designer, of course.
Yeah. Oh, sure. You can't ad-lib this stuff.
Right.
This is serious business.
Well, have fun and good luck on the tour.
Thank you.
The new Spinal Tap record will be released next month. Harry Shearer hosts a weekly program called Le Show, which is carried on many public radio stations. This is Fresh Air.